Chapter 5, The Mother of All Threats to My Yoga. It is not uncommon for a student who has been practicing for a while to inquire about the literature behind the Ashtanga practice. I often recommend the basics that were offered by Patabi Joyce when I asked him that question. He said Patanjali's Yoga Sutras were the first and most important, followed by Bhagavad Gita, Hatha Yoga Pradipika, and Shankara's Aparakshanubhuti. When I pressed further, he suggested Shankara's Brahma Sutra Bhashya, and he gave me a look that this one was important. He would often chant quietly under his breath while teaching, and when I asked, he told me it was the Isha Upanishad. In his book Yoga Mala, he quotes from the above texts and also references Shankara's Yoga Taravali, Vedanta and Aryaveda in general, various other Upanishads, and the Rig Veda. When one begins to pursue this library, it quickly becomes complicated. In particular, we begin to notice that disagreements have arisen and debates have ensued on almost every topic under discussion. These debates have been part of the story from nearly the beginning. Around 500 BC, the Buddha argued and disagreed with, among others, Upanishadic thinkers as well as materialists who were remarkably similar in their ideas to many scientists and philosophers today who argue from scientism, which is the belief that empirical science has all the answers to everything. The 8th century Brahma Sutra Bhashya is a very long debate between Shankara the Vedantin and his opponents. How do we sort through all these arguments and find the truth about yoga? I've come up with three categories that we can see today for those pursuing the theoretical aspect of the yogic quest. First, those who put their work into mastering and even memorizing a chosen canon, and for a large part, accepting those teachings as exactly presented. This is essentially taking a perspective of faith, and especially in the older texts like the Yoga Sutras, it is also considered one of the main ways of gaining knowledge. Resort to textual authority. If this seems quaint to you, think again. When the media presents a scientific finding, do you subject it to rigorous scrutiny or even try to replicate the experiment yourself? Most of us accept such reporting on faith. We have faith in science, and those who don't come off as crackpots, such as climate change deniers. However, this first category is the least critical and the most poetic, if you will, of my three categories, sinking deeply into the languages and in particular how the meanings therein can influence practice. And with good reason. All of the texts above, if pursued with sincerity, will reliably guide one's spiritual practice towards relative degrees of what has been considered enlightenment. I would put Patabi Joyce in this first category. When he gets critical, it tends to be about practice guidance rather than scholarly quibbling. For example, criticizing those who consider themselves scholars beyond compare, who nonetheless give in to lust and rage. The second category could be exemplified by Georg Forstein, who took the position of a critical scholar of yoga culture and languages in addition to viewing the literature for its spiritual value. In the process, he clearly declares himself as one who follows the guidance of these texts, not just one who looks at them from a distance. The third category can be represented by a group loosely calling themselves the Modern Yoga Researchers, who identify more as cultural and linguistic historians and critical scholars. They just so happen to be focusing on the yogic Eastern spirituality field, and as a rule, make no claims as to their own experiences. Spiritual values are less important from this perspective than truth, whether modern or postmodern. Morality, analysis of historical influence, and attempts at precise determinations of the meanings of old texts. Santa Barbara's David Gordon White and his entertaining writings, such as Sinister Yogis, is an exemplar. If we put aside practical debates about the best way to practice, we're left with arguments about the ideas themselves and the worldviews contained within those ideas. Of the above categories, the first category values primarily spiritual ideas, the second both spiritual and materialist, and the third primarily materialist and postmodern. What do I mean by materialist postmodern? In academics today, almost everybody is either materialist or postmodern, or they take the spiritual angle through aesthetics, or they do some combination of the three. This is to say that by and large they belong to my third category above. They often don't agree with each other, but what they do agree on is a wariness toward actual spiritual practice-generated spiritual data, which I'll get into in a bit. This has been the circumstance with intelligent, respected thinking. Academics doesn't have a yoga and doesn't seem to want one. As Batabi Joyce used to say, no yoga there. Which leads us to the following situation. If we pursue a practice such as yoga with the intent of self-development, with perhaps a quiet or not so quiet yearning for the possibility of enlightenment, we will begin to familiarize ourselves with the history of ideas behind such a quest. Researching these ideas, we will find that although the traditional literature clearly has spiritual intent behind all the debating, this literature is often surrounded by modern scholarship, much of which is neutral towards, or even dubious of, the value of spiritual practice itself. As we try to discern our way through these different perspectives, both within the traditions and in the more recent scholarship, we come to recognize that we have undertaken a process of philosophical inquiry and that we're going to have to weigh the evidence and come to our own conclusions. And if we follow any thread in philosophy, it will not take long before we run into a flat-out declaration that the entire spiritual pursuit is one big illusion and thus a falsehood. Or at best, begrudgingly, of possible practical benefit. The entire spectrum of higher spheres, of which almost the whole corpus of spiritual literature, East and West, is built upon, is typically cut to ribbons and left for dead. And we will begin to note that this voice is very loud and very prominent, the voice of materialism. The biggest current version is scientific materialism, and it is a formidable opponent. So the view we've been gaining through practice and through familiarity with spiritual materials and literature and community gets directly and rudely trumped by aggressive and sophisticated materialist negators and debunkers. In the face of this, many yogis just steer clear, carrying on with their practice and or teaching entirely unconcerned. I did this when I was younger, but lately, for better or worse, I've found the subject impossible to ignore. As I go about my research, I've learned to recognize when my quote-unquote Geiger counter starts clicking, as Ken Wilber puts it, which indicates an intensification of my interest level. And this is often the loudest when I feel a threat to my worldview, typically when the threatening thing contains something I recognize to be true. I've developed a taste for such threats. As a longtime professional yoga teacher, I can now say that the scientific materialist negation of spirit and ultimate meaning in life had been the mother of all threats to my yogic bliss. At existential hazard, I chose to face it, and it led me on a lengthy search for light in the darkness. This chapter represents one way through this maze. The argument I will engage has played itself out through history in a lengthy and dauntingly complicated process, but it can be generally simplified as that of materialist versus idealist, which I see as the main issue. Postmodernism has its own attacks against both fields, but I see this debate as now relatively peripheral. Postmodernism's more powerful contribution and extremely lively debate currently applied more toward multiculturalism. Aggressive materialist negation of spirituality can lead us to doubt some of the more hopeful implications of our yogic experience. It certainly has in my case. This is not necessarily a bad thing. If what we are doing is real, it will be able to withstand challenges, and any serious practitioner will feel doubts coming and going as the self-inquiry process proceeds. Discernment in yoga is just as needed as it is in science. On the other hand, a common teaching in yoga is the value of some protection for our practice realizations, treating them like delicate plants which require loving care until they can get rooted more strongly. I believe this is true, and if you put yourself in this category, you may want to stop reading this now or listening to this now. Spoiler alert, this chapter has what I take to be a happy ending. The first 15 or so years of my efforts of practicing teaching and holding a community of yogis together were periodically marked by internal and external upheavals that could make it extremely challenging to gracefully face the room of students in front of me. To make a Mysore-based Ashtanga Yoga Shala work day by day with the many trials of what it is to hold a higher kind of energy which manifests collectively and maintains interest month after month, one often feels he has little room for error. My first 5 years, I would sometimes nearly get whacked right out of the room. Somewhere around that 15-year mark of teaching, I must have finally put down deep enough roots, and I felt ready to drink the materialist Kool-Aid straight, determined to get at the truth. One of my drives in this was to engage the larger picture behind a feeling I get after being exposed to some materialist ideas and approaches, a feeling captured by David Loy as quote-unquote degraded worldview, a view also frequently referred to as flatland. The strongest I've felt this has been after reading Steven Pinker's How the Mind Works. And when it comes to that feeling of raw threat, a sense that something precious and essential is being gutted and raped, the best author has been Daniel Dennett, especially as Darwin's dangerous idea. One of the reasons they both rattle me so effectively is that I admire them and their work, especially Dennett. Indeed, about a decade ago, I began to hear Geiger counter clicks around neuroscience. I had been swimming in the yogic arts and literature as well as psychology, both developmental and Jungian, and I had been working as a yoga teacher and musician. I did lots of meditation and hatha yoga. This is where my experience and research had been. This was the kind of data I had been taking in. I recognized I was fairly ignorant about science. Undaunted, I began studying the sciences, in particular the literature of the brain, as much as I could, and derived great benefit. But as Stuart Kaufman notes, virtually all neurobiologists hold the view that consciousness is entirely mechanically generated. It wasn't long before I felt the tension growing between the materialist outlook and my own view. Simultaneously, I began following the growing avalanche of data from the lab about the material benefits of spiritual practice, i.e., yoga makes your brain grow, decreases stress markers, is good for heart health, etc. This is the current emergence of clear evidence from the material view that spiritual practices have material benefit and can be fruitfully pursued entirely from that perspective. In fact, as I was checking out the popular current atheist group, the Four Horsemen, I pretty quickly sniffed out that Sam Harris, one of the horsemen, has legitimate yogi credentials, which is to say lots of hard practice and meditation, quite beyond just trying the hat on. Which is also to say, it is possible to pursue spiritual techniques from an entirely materialist, even nihilist, point of view. And if yoga and mysticism really are simply ways of tapping into unusual brain states, including getting good at recruiting the brain's happy chemicals, then what's the problem? Don't worry, be happy. But as Daniel Dennett hints, many scientists may not have actually followed that materialist view all the way to its necessary conclusion, don't really want to, because it can be rough and scary. More on that below. Back in May of 2015, there was a fairly interesting exchange that illustrates that year's model of the ongoing fracas, published in the Washington Post, between popular author Deepak Chopra and Stephen Newton, who is the director for programs and policy for the National Center for Science Education. Newton began the exchange with a tongue-in-cheek piece that dripped with acidic sarcasm towards Chopra's apparently obvious pseudo-scientific New Age buffoonery on the subject of evolution, Newton offering instead a perhaps humorously exaggerated grim view of eat-or-be-eaten Darwinism. It may have been tongue-in-cheek, but it was definitely not friendly. Chopra fired back in a manner that made it clear that he may not be such a clown after all, offering his case for the role of consciousness in evolution, in addition to chiding Newton for flirting with internet troll vibe. Newton responded in turn with an altered demeanor of recognition that he had to take this debate seriously, concluding his conservative materialist outlook with a warning that Chopra is aiding and abetting fundamentalist creationists and intelligent designers because his untested ideas resemble theirs. Now, Newton had a point as regards creationists in America. One study that year concluded that the number of Americans who believe that matter and life happened as described by the book of Genesis is at approximately 45%. And Newton's urgency had some justification. Other surveys showed that somewhere between 25 and 50% of Americans didn't believe in climate change, and this view was typically accompanied by a skepticism towards science. There was also another dimension to the exchange. Newton was warning Chopra to stay out of the scientific playground unless he is willing to enter the fire of peer-reviewed discussion, which has nearly zero tolerance for speculation without lab-quality evidence. In his response, he marshaled experimental findings to support his points. Chopra, in his turn, while clearly demonstrating his familiarity with the contours of the present rich debate about mind, consciousness, and evolution, offered his position as that of a provocateur of new ideas. Quote, unquote, "I work with high-level scientists, including physicists, geneticists, and others who believe, as I do, that mainstream science, like mainstream medicine, has a lot to gain from keeping the flow of ideas moving." Presumably, it will be these scientific colleagues of Chopra's who will enter the actual scientific journal environment, their imaginations piqued by Chopra as to how to set up the experiments. And Newton also made a big mistake. Chopra is no friend of the creationists. He is a practitioner and integrator of current psycho-spiritual technology, which can be likened to creationist religion in a similar manner as string theory is to medieval alchemy. Chopra has a substantial audience, partly because of the large number of people who are practicing yoga in some form right now. Many people with spiritual inclinations have moved far beyond mythic-level religion. Allow me now to present two stories. The first is heavily indebted to Sri Aurobindo, who in turn drew from both the great corpus of Indian philosophy as well as European idealism of the early 19th century, which includes Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel, to help unpack his own profound yoga practice. We could call this story a version of the life divine or the great chain of being. It goes like this, story number one, the idealist story. There was a being. Call it any name. It could be Satchitananda, or Krishna, or Yahweh, with or without Jesus, with or without the prophet. It could be Great Spirit, God, any name. Let's just call it Spirit for now. It had no form that we can understand, but it desired to fulfill itself by coming into being as matter, like that in our universe. So it caused a big bang. Hydrogen, helium, and lithium suffused into space. The basic laws that governed these elements were either already there, or they developed over time. Gradually, gravity shaped the hydrogen, helium, and lithium into clumps, which heated up through fusion and became stars. The hydrogen in the stars turned into helium. As the stars ran out of hydrogen, they began to create other elements, including oxygen, nitrogen, iron, zinc. Stars eventually began blowing up and expelled these elements out into space. Time passed. Some pieces of these blown-up stars got caught in the orbits of other stars and turned into spherical planets. Some of these planets, at least ours, happened to reside in the Goldilocks zone, places in solar systems where the ratios between sun and planet and moons are such that the stage is set for the elements to begin radically arranging themselves into organized patterns. Some of these patterns became complex enough that they began to show signs of agency, separate units acting of their own accord. Time passed. The complexity of these patterns increased. Some units developed features that others didn't have, which allowed them to proliferate better than the others, or at the expense of the others. They took on more elements and put them in their unique capacities to use, such as iron and zinc, in ways that conferred further advantage. Complexity increased. They gained more abilities. Bacteria arose, and then worms, and fishes, and then lizards, and then rodents, and then monkeys, and then people. There were other branches, such as the dolphins, but it was the monkey line that burst through first. Along the way, amazing things called neurons developed, and those who found themselves with larger numbers of neurons proliferated abundantly. Humans grew this cognitive niche to the degree that they began to outsmart all the other creatures. And they also began to think and reflect on their situation. They created civilization and culture and gained safety and leisure. From this place, they slowly accrued a knowledge of the forces that operate in the universe. Some of them also awakened within themselves a consciousness which was sleeping, as it subtly guided the elemental play, but now was capable of being perceived. People developed psycho-spiritual technology of various types, which allowed some of them, the brave pioneers at first, to go along inner pathless paths, whereby they awakened to the fact that the spirit is within them and is and had been the eyes through which they had viewed the universe from the beginning. They're gradually remembering who they have been all along. The purpose of the entire quote-unquote show has been to awaken to the spirit and to realize it within oneself, such that matter and spirit are united. From this perspective, humans can become agents of proliferate creation, much like spirit before them, taking things into greater and greater complexity and beauty, the delight of the experience of which joins them in the ongoing lila, divine play, which was the reason spirit began the whole ordeal and passion in the first place. The delight of Leela allows us to see that the messy nature of evolution, the starts and stops, mistakes and triumphs, were part of a creative process, like a work of art and a work in progress. People now can consciously assume their role in the ongoing delight, drama, passion, and satisfaction of the cosmos. Quite an appealing story, isn't it? This is my updated edition. Even since Aurobindo wrote The Life Divine, much has been discovered by science to flesh it out. Okay, now, take the previous story, the idealist creation story, and cut out the first part, all the way basically to the sentence about the Big Bang, and then turn that sentence into simply, there was a Big Bang. So we're not saying anything about spirit, we're just saying, there was a Big Bang. And then we follow the developmental process all the way up to where the sentence was, they slowly accrue a knowledge of the forces that operate in the universe. So we've already risen up from prokaryotes to lizards to fishes to humans, and then they start figuring out civilization. And from there we'll proceed with the story, which becomes story number two, the materialist story. It goes like this. Through this process of discovery, they conclude that, unlikely as it might seem, all this beauty and complexity and design is the product of mere chance working through the physical forces and elements over time. We are what we are, consciousness and all, merely because certain organization of atoms survive better than others, and right now the human form is among the best out there. The Big Bang happened and the elements exist, and there is nothing else to be said as to why they happened and why they are here. That's the materialist story. And in the words of Daniel Dennett, that's all there is to it. If we faithfully follow the implications of materialism, there can be no other conclusion. Degraded worldview. Kind of grim. A common materialist response to this bleak picture is, well, we don't necessarily want it to be like this, but this is how it is. We need to tell the truth. This is the truth that has been revealed to us by the data. The data does not support that first story, the idealist story. We have and must build our meanings and purposes in life on top of empirical truth. Stop worrying about it. Get over it. You can still enjoy your life. Besides, you get to be free within and without from all those old power trips parading as religious rules. So, such a dichotomy between these two worldviews. Here's another way it can play out. Say you listen to a piece of music. You're quite touched by it. Tears come to your eyes and you feel an exquisite feeling. It seems to open your heart. You've had a fabulous aesthetic experience. Straight-up materialist Steven Pinker would render it like this. The music fan has, quote-unquote, a mind that rises to a biologically pointless challenge, figuring out how to get at the pleasure circuits of the brain and deliver little jolts of enjoyment without the inconvenience of wringing bona fide fitness increments from the harsh world. End quote. This follows from the observation that some parts of the mind register the attainment of increments of fitness by giving us a sensation of pleasure. Here's a version of the other side. Eros is a force that is woven into the fabric of the universe. It is a subtle guide that beckons arrangements of matter into ever greater complexity through a force which is ceaseless new creativity, and in the case of those who have attained a sufficient level of self-consciousness, i.e. humans or maybe dolphins, toward ever greater self-recognition. At the simpler levels of organization, jolts of enjoyment are part of a useful reward system towards self-preservation and reproduction. At the human level, and for animals at play, they become part of the ongoing lila, pulled by a loving urge for ever greater complexity and ever-increasing recognition of the spirit which lives within us. The experience of musical delight is a significant Eros event, a contribution to the divine dance, and an education for the listener about her true identity, which is non-different from spirit itself. It is revealed signs on the road to heaven. All right. We have these opposing cosmic views. Our first cosmic story, the updated variation on the Great Chain of Being, has shown itself to be within the predominant family of views arrived at by people who have seriously pursued spiritual practice throughout history. These often aren't the church fathers or popes or preachers or rabbis or Brahmin royalty, but rather the monks and mystics and nuns and yogis, the ones actively engaged in spiritual practices, which is different than just thinking about spirit or laws or ideas. And it is different than controlling others. There are no laws inscribed on stone tablets from the spirit, although laws such as gravity and electromagnetism are likely closer to the mark, but rather a subtle beckoning towards greater complexity and delight. On the other hand, variations on the second story have been the view of materialists, accepted at varying degrees since at least the time of the Buddha. I've argued in the Sinet chapter that there is an additional source of empirical data available to people either by gift or spiritual practice from the sixth sense, which I'm calling internal subtle feeling. This adds complexity to a philosophical debate about materialism and mind based on the fact that we can't just rely on sensory data to gain knowledge about the world. So, for vision, sensory data at its root is just colored patches. One can't do any meaningful science from colored patches only. We need to resort to mind moves to organize these colored patches. The big question is this: are these mind moves, or quote-unquote applications of the categories, a use of tools that have an unknown source, or did they evolve with the development of the brain in a Darwinistic fashion, thus being essentially biological nerve stuff? Can the forms of thought be seen entirely as behaviors evolved and shared with others at the neurological level on a par with those which have evolved and been shared with, for example, our hands? Or could there be a spirit-originated source of the mental categories and algorithms which we use to organize raw sensory data, forms that spirit has periodically through time thrown into the mental and even material fray to help elements and forces come to life? This is an angle into the mind-body philosophical problem. I'm not going to go too deep into that endless rabbit hole beyond stating this. Encounters with a Sinet through spiritual practice such as yoga opens empirical experience of mind-body forms transmitted between, at minimum, people in a way that would require a transmission medium currently not understood or accepted by materialist worldviews. This may be the way that spirit conveys organizing patterns and algorithms to life on earth and categories to mind. The term spirit can be used for anything that comes from a dimension not currently comprehended by science. I offer the views of some recent prominent thinkers, I'll be doing that next, who deviate from strict materialism by leaving a crack for such a mystery to shine through. Anyway, those who do yoga and mysticism well, in all its myriad forms, often eventually report a story which is a variant on story number one above, the idealist story. This story has emerged across cultures far removed. And again, these yogas, these psycho-spiritual technologies are not mythic religious stories like the biblical creation myth. They are rather the contemplative core of the world's religions. Judaism has Kabbalah, Christianity has monastic monks and nuns, Islam has Sufis, and for some reason India just went straight for it and emerged with their yogas close to the public surface within Buddhism and Vedanta. Good yogis are just as intently focused as good scientists and have equal integrity. These yogis and mystics residing at the nucleus of the world's religions were not just thinkers and theorizers. Rather, they were primarily practitioners learning, using, experimenting with, and propagating psycho-spiritual technologies with certain features shared cross-culturally, such as intensely focused inward attention and periods of solitude. To deny their validity, one must undertake the practices themselves and then prove them false. Without that, no yogi could take you seriously. It would be like a yogi walking into a science lab, looking at a few test tubes, and declaring the whole venture a big charade, which would have the scientists rolling on the floor. Any materialist who denies spiritual experience and reality without undertaking spiritual practices is just as foolish, and the intimidating yoga ladies would look at him askance. Add to this that many scientists and philosophers in general don't even conceive of ever going outside of or beyond discursive mind. I'll lay out my personal position at this point, which I can report from actual experience without any leaps into quote-unquote metaphysics. This is to say that although I'm inclined towards story number one above, the idealist story, I cannot claim the entire thing with much certainty, although it feels intuitively right. My current yogic experience, both individually and collectively, is that there is without a doubt a subtle realm, sukshma sharira, with its subtle senses, sukshma indriya. Subtle phenomenon can be seen as less dense forms of matter energy slash energy. For example, a person's energy field. Gross phenomena are on the denser end of the spectrum, for example, a football. The entire spectrum from gross to subtle to very subtle plays itself out on the stage within a spaciousness that can be likened to the theater in which a play occurs. The realization of this spaciousness beyond the gross to subtle play on the stage has been widely considered the act of spiritual enlightenment. This spaciousness carries an unmistakable sense of I-ness. It feels as if it is our own identity, and this is where the plot thickens. I'm not inferring that the spacious I-ness must be there. I actually experience it regularly. It presents empirical data to those who experience it. This is not the usual empiricism, which is solid knowledge of objects within the gross senses, but non-dual empiricism, which is equally solid knowledge of shifts in our perspective and identity, durably experienced through repetition. Just as Einstein's new physics responded to data in ways that disturbed the scientists who themselves were discovering it because of what it did to the secure Newtonian worldview, so yoga practice, which generates subtle data, tends to do the same to materialism. This is largely because the exploration of the subtle realms is not just a quote-unquote looking at things, but also brings us into engagement with a process whereby we experience a shift in our identity. It also makes more space for consciousness itself, thereby confirming the reality of that consciousness empirically. We actually sense it. I have sensed it. And what I have sensed is the potential of my own pure identity. Also, internal subtle feeling is as much an engagement of forces as it is an observation of them. From these somewhat dramatic perspectives and realms, degraded worldviews tend to lose their draw. Keeping this in mind, if we practice yoga today, we can arrive at an understanding of the cosmos, which includes every shred of good science that's been done through history right up to today, and it will still remain possible to have room for a view that recognizes spirit. I would like to back this statement up with two approaches, one that reveals the way that a good percentage of hard scientists and rigorous philosophers themselves have viewed the debate, and the second is to offer a few suggestions that speak of data sources difficult or impossible to collect in traditional empirical scientific lab settings. First, let me offer an extremely condensed view of the rise of materialism. Although the strands disappear into the darkness of history, including the above-mentioned opponents of the Buddha, the strength of the current Western view stems from the irresistible urge for human thought to liberate itself from the confines of established religion. A first big flower was in the 1500s when Copernicus presented his discovery that it was the sun at the center of things, not the earth, which rattled the Pope's metaphysicians. Copernicus was careful and savvy and stayed mostly out of trouble, but Galileo, in furthering the ideas, nearly got on the wrong side of the Inquisition, which threatened hot consequences. Nonetheless, science was not to be stopped, and it began blooming forth at every angle. By the late 1700s, Kant, who himself was not a materialist, blew the candle out of traditional metaphysics, such as the classic proofs of God, unintentionally giving rise to an unfettered proliferation of materialism. 19th century notables were Karl Marx, boiling spirit down to the subject who views the products of material labor, Friedrich Nietzsche, hoping that a Dionysian frenzy would compensate for the death of God, and of course, the big guy for our current materialists, Darwin, sorry for the blow he was delivering to the faithful and yet delivering it with the force of Thor's hammer. Into the 20th century, we find the existentialists, gleeful of the freedoms from the Big Brother Church, yet mourning the quote-unquote God-shaped hole in their head where God used to be. And the exceptionally influential Freud, who told us God was just a part of our subconscious and called it the superego. Not long after, the Holocaust left Jews and people of faith everywhere muttering, "What the hell happened to God? There's no God here." Simultaneously, logical positivism took over large swaths of philosophy, influencing scientists and beating up idealists and theologians. By the 70s, even the postmodernists, who were whacking with all their might at science, also attacked spirit with their assault on introspection, demanding that everybody remain on the surface, far from the depths required for any actual knowledge of spirit. And today, as evidenced by the Newton-Chopra exchange previously mentioned, materialism is still trying to carry the day and banish the spookiness in much of academia. And again, in its scientific materialist form, it's formidable. Whereas the logical positivists and behaviorists at its roots crossed into the ludicrous, denying any interior life to the mind at all, which is one very efficient definition of insanity, the current crop of cognitive scientists allow and even practice much of the richness of life that any humanist or artist would insist upon, but couch it in strictly materialist causes. However, as a yogi, I still hold the position that there is more. And the case is far from closed. Within science and academic philosophy, there are many thinkers who have delineated limits to the materialist view, opening the possibility up of our first story above, the life divine. Before I get into them, though, it is essential to side with Stephen Newton here that this definitely does not mean that we can plug our good old-fashioned Christianity story, or any other myth, into the gaps in materialism noticed by such thinkers. In fact, every one of these guys below would debunk a merely mythical-level religion. Rather, I find that these hard scientists and philosophers are actually closer to a mystical view that can work in today's world than most of the theologians of their times, and they present a very solid theoretical foundation which a strong yoga practice can infuse with bliss. So, beginning with the new physics that broke open that field in the first part of the 20th century, Einstein likened his spirituality to the view of Baruch Spinoza, who held that God has thought and extension, the extension being our creation, this universe, presumably one among others. This view fits in well with updated Great Chain stories. It is also similar to Erwin Schrödinger's view, which has been described as Vedantic. De Broglie declared that the quote-unquote mechanism demands a mysticism. And Max Planck said that God is, quote, the crown of any reasoning concerning this worldview. Arthur Eddington said, quote, unquote, consciousness is not sharply defined, but fades into subconsciousness. And beyond that, we must postulate something indefinite, but yet continuous with our mental nature. Wolfgang Pauli had the following side to his life, as quoted in Wikipedia. The Pauli effect was named after the anecdotal bizarre ability of his to break experimental equipment simply by being in the vicinity. Pauli was aware of his reputation and was delighted whenever the Pauli effect manifested. This led him to work with C.G. Jung, no great fan of materialism, exploring the paranormal. Werner Heisenberg held out for Platonic archetypes, and he shares variants on this view with Roger Penrose, the eminent contemporary mathematician and physicist, as well as Noam Chomsky, the man who gave birth to cognitive science, and was convinced that our language capacity cannot be explained by materialistic Darwinism. The brilliant and lauded mathematician Kurt Gödel was quite sure that his two incompleteness theorems proved that materialism was an inadequate view of the mind. Stuart Kaufman and Henry Stapp are two scientists, among many others, who hold a quantum view of mind, which opens the door to the same mysteries that the above pioneering physicists could only fill with spirit. But my primary interest in Kaufman stems from his other main idea, which he culled from his pioneering work in chaos and complexity theories, that of self-organization, which was the result of quote-unquote years of muttering at Darwin that there must be some other force at work in evolution beyond simple, mindless natural selection. Stephen Jay Gould also held out for some additional process in Darwinistic evolution. Another theme that has developed among serious thinkers has been panpsychism, which views consciousness as existing in all things. The smaller the particle, the less the consciousness, all the way down to atoms and whatever is below them. Leibniz, the creator of calculus, held this view, as did William James. The esteemed mathematical philosophers Alfred North Whitehead and Bertrand Russell supported it. Russell's view was that mental and physical aspects of existence are the same, but not reducible to the physical. More recently, philosopher David Chalmers has offered it as a possible explanation for how neurons and their firings, which is a physical process, can give rise to the experience of consciousness. Chalmers made a big splash in the mid-90s with his breaking up of the philosophy of mind between the easy problem and the now famous hard problem. The hard problem takes up the challenge of how to use strictly materialist explanations for the sense of self that accompanies all of our experiences, the sense that there's an I looking at that tree. Many philosophers and scientists currently share his view that mere neuronal processes are insufficient to provide us with this experience, that there is something about consciousness which cannot be reduced to materialist explanation, that consciousness is an irreducible force in the universe. Daniel Dennett claims that there is no hard problem. The issue with philosophy of mind is that either one affirms this view of irreducibility of consciousness or has variations of skepticism about it. The skeptics, such as Dennett, may claim instead that consciousness is, for example, merely a projection of neural spike trains in an algorithmic process, similar to the way pits and lands in a DVD put us under the illusion that a real scene is being projected onto our TV screen. The sense of I is a creation of algorithms in the brain. On the other hand, if one affirms consciousness as an irreducible reality, then the gateway to a full expression of yoga has been opened. Yoga has always stated that that very consciousness within you, the entity that feels a sense that there is someone viewing that tree, that very someone, if pursued with rigorous focus in various ways, becomes all the God there is and has ever been, the spirit that is dwelling within you right now and has been there all along without you knowing it. The mystics and yogis tell us that that presence is actually the witness that views the entire show of life, and yogic process will allow us to free ourselves from needing to keep it just to ourselves in selfish, egoistic form, realizing rather that this is the self that pervades all of the eyes of the world. So, all of the previously mentioned scientists and thinkers together, each of whom is a heavyweight in the scientific philosophical world, offer a broadside toward the grim materialist view. Again, they don't in the least herald the triumphant return of Jesus, and they won't bring back God who will answer our prayers with interventions on our personal behalf. Rather, these are guys who bring scientific findings to the table that we cannot ignore while hoping to remain in integrity with the state of current human knowledge. But wonderfully, they also offer a view of the cosmos into which spirit can easily integrate. And there's also one other thing to notice about these guys, along with the strict materialist opponents who they debate. That is, they're all guys. Which brings in the next question, into which I will tread carefully. Where are the women in the story? In 2015, the media ran a typical story of women trying to work their way into astronomy at UC Berkeley and having to contend with a sexually predatory potential Nobel Prize-winning male professor who ruled the department. This was before the Me Too floodgates opened up following Trump's election, ushering in a cascade of such whistleblowing events. One revelation of all of this has been that the hard sciences are the academic departments most resistant to female cohabitation. They're also the ones most likely to espouse the materialist worldview. Compare this to my yoga studio where the roster is 90% female. That number is a bit higher than Yoga Journal's report of the national average, which is 83%. The reasons for this gender disparity in current Western Hatha Yoga have been debated for a few decades. One factor can be found in Hatha Yoga's history, which shows it to be a far more embodied form of older Patanjali-style yoga, and is marked by a surge in the worship of the goddess. Suffice to say that there is something about embodied psycho-spiritual technology that attracts women and gets into what has been called women's ways of knowing. I will take Carol Gilligan as a suitable and relevant feminist scholar whose research concludes that men are more inclined to quote-unquote rights and justice and women toward quote-unquote care and responsibility. Another contrast has been separate agency for men and connectedness for women. Taking the broad brushstrokes of these female-male differences, how can we view our opposing idealist versus materialist worldviews? Quite simply, the yoga process, especially a group hatha yoga process, among a community of people familiar with one another, can lead to a deep feeling of connectedness. Connectedness to community, one's own body, and to shared, subtler forms of awareness. Yoga, often translated as union, and spirituality in general, aside from old religious trappings and rules, is a way of connecting with physical and mental process and investing energy in these processes, thereby eventually breaking down inner barriers out of which floods new life and new data, which has always been said to facilitate the capacity to transcend the isolation of the separate ego and open one to higher connections. Those who do this a lot frequently state that they feel a presence all around them, a spirit that both transcends and is infused into ordinary life and matter. And feeling is a valid source of empirical data, although it has been without value in the scientific lab, where vision is God. In intimate relationships, research has shown that whereas men value looks in a woman, women place more value on how it feels to be with a particular man. I've noticed that many women who are hard-headed scientists do not buy the materialist view. One example is Claire Pert, the discoverer of endorphins, who in her book Molecules of Emotion offers a passionate urge for both science and embodied real connection to this earth and the spiritual process. She's big enough to embrace them both, and I wonder why so many materialist men have such a hard time with that. And of course, there are also deliberate straight-ahead materialist women, and there are also atheist women, but I believe this is partly because religion has been a dreadful misogynistic force in history. Our atheist meditator friend Sam Harris notes that his fan base is 70-30 in favor of males. One of my big complaints here concerns the fact that in materialist views, there is frequently not merely a denial of the possibility of any kind of spirit in the creation and development of the world, but there is also a debunking of the entire subtle realm, which I find incredibly clueless. So finally, my position becomes the following. The materialist worldview has missed two things, psycho-spiritual technology and the influence of strong women. It has missed the data that comes from a sustained quality yoga practice, and it has missed the connectedness of women. I'm a lover of science. I really look forward to what's coming out of the lab next, especially about the brain, exercise physiology, and the effects of mindfulness practices. But I've done way too much yoga to ignore what I've learned by doing it. If I keep this spiritual knowledge in mind, I find that I do not love the materialist story and find it exceptionally partial, just one part of a much bigger story. Steven Pinker has said that science, to put it mildly, has not been kind to common sense. My response is that history has not been kind, to put it mildly, to scientists who say, in the words of Daniel Dennett, quote unquote, "That's all there is to it." Experience in yoga tells us there is more.